From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the program, a Milwaukee-area psychologist urges us to take suicide seriously as a public health issue.
Starting in 2013 until the end of March, there have been 41 people killed in school shootings. Every year, 1,000 youths alone kill themselves with a firearm.
Later, a Wisconsin native produces a documentary on some of the first American women to serve in the military.
That was a huge leap. And you have to remember, women didn't even have the right to vote when these women went to war.
Plus, a one-woman show put on by two theater companies.
And what would we do if we knew an asteroid might hit the Earth? Besides screaming, that is.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The recent deaths of food writer and host Anthony Bourdain and designer Kate Spade have cast the issue of suicide back into the public eye. But while those high-profile cases generated headlines, suicide has been a significant public health issue for years. In fact, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death, both in Wisconsin and nationally.
The suicide rate is also climbing. Between 1999 and 2016, there was a 25% increase in the rate of death by suicide around the country. Dr. Sarah Coleman is a clinical psychologist with the Milwaukee County's Behavioral Health Division. She says the current statistics may not even accurately reflect the full extent of the problem. She explains coming to grips with it may require a general shift in approach.
I think a lot of people think of suicide as a free will choice. And I really think it's part of the way that people view what that kind of death means, to think that it's different than an illness like cancer or a car accident, something you wouldn't have chosen. I think those of us that work in mental health have a different way of seeing it, which is that the people who are sick enough in the moment, whether they have a chronic mental illness or not, they're sick enough in that moment that suicide becomes the only option, but that if you can give them some time between that moment and a future moment, sometimes it's literally a few minutes later, they wouldn't have chosen for their lives to be over. You know, they're not in their clearest minds at the moment. So
you mentioned there's, of course, the mental health component. But I'm curious, what is unique to Milwaukee or Wisconsin or the Midwest? You know, we see that nationally it's raised in suicide rates. But what's unique to our area?
Our area, in general, we have two big issues that feed into suicide a lot. The first one is alcohol. You know, as we've seen in other topics discussed, Wisconsin has a very unfortunately high binge drinking and just drinking in general rate. The second part that is kind of makes Wisconsin stand out is that we're a high prevalence firearm ownership. So firearms do not cause someone to become suicidal, but if you are feeling suicidal in the moment and you choose to use a gun as your means to end your life, the lethality is just so much higher. So they found that states that are, you know, high prevalence of ownership just have at least a 2x rate of suicide compared to other states.
So there's a greater means to accessing these ways to commit suicide. Do you think there needs to be a reduction of access to these lethal items? I mean, how do we even begin to see that in what role it plays in suicide when gun control is also seen as something with school shootings, with states' rights, with personal rights?
Yeah, I like that you brought up school shootings because that gets a lot of publicity. So starting in 2013 until the end of March, there have been 41 people killed in school shootings. Every year, 1,000 youths alone kill themselves with a firearm. Every single year, 1,000 children between the ages of 10 and 19 die at their own hand with a firearm. So I'm not here to talk about gun control at all, but and it doesn't even have to be that. I'm not saying when you say that you need to reduce means, it's not about removing entirely, but it's about securing and making it secure. So when it comes to firearms, we're asking for people to keep their firearms unloaded in a locked, secure location. A good test is to ask your child, "Try to get my gun out," and you'd be surprised how often they can actually get your gun out when you don't think that they can. There are also lots of places that you can get gun locks, so that's an added protection. But it's not just firearms. If you are concerned about someone, take away their medication, take away their car keys. There are lots of ways that someone can die, you know, at their own hands.
Or even securing your own medication that can be
exactly
used by
right.
Else.
And that is what we do often when we're intervening with someone who is at risk, is doing things like that, taking away those means.
So you mentioned with alcohol and firearms in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Milwaukee is also known for its gun violence. I mean, mm-hmm. we've had series on the station before strictly about it. So are there other Milwaukee factors and, you know, the role that trauma can play mm-hmm. in contributing to suicide rates?
Yeah. First, just a tiny plug for Milwaukee. We actually do better than the rest of the state. Pretty much the entire rest of the state and the state as a whole has a higher suicide rate than our particular county does. I'm not speaking of the city, but the county. Over the past, let's say, 3 years, they've averaged right around 15 deaths per 100,000 when we've averaged right around 11 deaths per 100,000. There's something different about the gun culture here than there is, I think, in the rest of the state, also in the drinking culture. I think those are some important differences. But we know that there is a lot of socioeconomic issues in our part of the state. There is, you know, unemployment issues in this particular area. I think those factor in. When you speak about trauma, that's not going to be specific to Milwaukee or to Wisconsin or to our country, but trauma for sure is a predictor of what your risk is and your future, you know, chances of ending your own life. It reduces your resilience so that when life's hard things come around, you don't have the same resilience to fight back. Also, a lot of times people who go through a trauma, such as a childhood trauma, some kind of abuse or neglect, then they're growing up without a natural support system.
One thing that's been highlighted recently with celebrity suicides such as Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the idea that suicide is contagious.
It is. It, you know, unfortunately is. We don't entirely understand why, but we do know that it is. So whether you are exposed at a media level to someone famous that you didn't know, or it's someone in your circle, meaning your school or your town, or someone you personally know, any of those kind of exposures increase your risk of your own suicidal experience. I haven't ever found there to be an increase in risk for someone who's not already at risk on some level. One of the studies that I did find in preparing for today was related to the death of Robin Williams. That was one of the ones that got some actual research behind it. It was about a 10% increase after his death, and there was a marked increase in strangulation deaths, which is, of course, unfortunately, how he passed away.
What do you think contributes to that, you know, not just completing the act of suicide, but by the same methods?
Mm-hmm. I think that there is a, you know, we have these connections, especially to famous people that are, you know, entirely in our heads, but we have them nonetheless. And we make certain assumptions about famous people. You know, she's so beautiful and she has so much money and he was so successful and he made so many people happy through his movies. And if he couldn't find a reason to go on, what do I have to live for? You know, my life, I'm already feeling crappy. You have that, you know, that moment where you just say, well, what am I doing here if they're not here? I think one other thing that's important about suicide is sometimes people say, well, she would never do that. She's a mom. She has children. You know, she would never end her life. Like exactly in the cases of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, they are both parents to relatively young children. You know, they had these careers, etc. But one of the important things to look for when you're looking for someone and what kind of risk they are at is, do they consider themselves a burden? If you think of yourself as a burden, even to your children, ending your life is actually a gift to your children in your head in that moment. And so I think when you're talking about, you know, checking in with your own loved ones, and that's an important thing to keep in mind.
So these numbers are not surprising doctors or clinicians such as yourself, but the public is always taken aback mm-hmm. by increased suicide rates or when someone commits suicide. Often people report that it's kind of out of left field. So is there a way to have a better understanding of the circumstances surrounding suicide, or is there just groundwork that we need to instill in ourselves and teaching to others that needs to be a good basis mm-hmm. from the ground up?
Mm-hmm. Like most mental health problems, I think, you know, ideally you want to start at the very beginning. You want to teach kids coping skills. How do you deal with something that goes wrong? You don't want to save your children from everything. You want to help them figure out some of their own battles and how to fix those. Because as a grown up, you know, we don't have those same parents or whoever fighting for us in the same way. So, you know, ideally it starts at the very beginning. But as far as the coming out of left field, it doesn't come out of left field. There are usually warning signs, and not just sign, but signs. So having a mental illness is always going to be a risk factor. So if you have a serious mental illness, that is going to greatly increase your chances that this might be part of your life at some point, whether it's a suicide attempt or you end up dying by suicide. Lots of risk factors, though. Substance problems in general, you know, someone who has a chronic drinking problem, again, who's gone through a relapse, someone that's gone through some kind of traumatic event, whether it was in their past or recently. And we can think of trauma meaning abuse, but we also need to think of trauma meaning a divorce or a natural disaster like a flood or any of those things like that also really increase your chances. Having a history of a suicide attempt is one of the highest predictors. So, there's definitely not a lot of left field, but I know that, you know, that's kind of a more common way of thinking about it sometimes, yeah.
So what should someone do or say if they believe someone is suicidal?
I think that the most important first step is to take them seriously, to listen to them, to not be afraid to ask the question. Sometimes people say, I think I'm going to kill myself, but more often people are going to say, I'm just not interested anymore in what's, I don't really care if I don't get that job. What? You know, it's just things like that. It's a little more passive, and it's more just an interest in not living. And so I think asking questions at a time like this, clear-cut, directed questions. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you thinking about dying? Would that be better for you? You know, those are hard questions to ask, but those are the questions you have to ask. If you talk to someone and you think they're suicidal and you think that that risk is imminent, you call 911. Just like if they're having a heart attack, anything that's going to, you know, increase your chances of dying shortly, call 911. That's always going to be your first step. If you, you know, don't think that that's what's going on, then you can use some of those other resources. And then getting someone to help. You know, it's your loved one, but you need someone who knows, has had a lot of experience working with someone like that so that you can, they can help them get the help that they need.
So what are some resources or efforts underway in Milwaukee that can connect those people who need help?
Okay. Well, first we have our crisis line. So there's a national suicide crisis line, and that crisis line feeds into our local line. So locally you can call the local line, which that number is 414-257-7222, and that's staffed by the crisis team through the Milwaukee Behavioral Health Division. In addition, we have two crisis resource centers. There's one at 5409 West Villard, and there's one at 2057 South 14th Street. Those are drop-in centers that someone can go to if they're having a hard time. We have our 24/7 psychiatric emergency room. That's out at the Behavioral Health Division on Watertown Plank. Someone can bring someone there, or someone can self-present themselves there and just say, I'm having a hard time, and get, you know, routed to the right kind of treatment. There's a national text helping line. So for someone who doesn't want to actually talk to someone about this, you can text, and that number is 741-741. And you can text and just say, I'm feeling like dying, and they'll get you some help.
So we hear about the aftermath of someone dying by suicide. There's the news reports, but then it kind of filters out of everyone's radar for a while. But what happens after someone dies by suicide?
Well, you know, if we're talking again about someone in the media, we want to keep an eye on the people that we're either working with in my field or just family members or whomever, and just make sure that they're getting the help they need. If you are someone who has unfortunately lived through someone that you cared about dying, you know, trying to reach out to a therapist of your own or a support group, or there are lots of different organizations that are trying to fight against this horrible condition that is suicide. It's one of the things that I think is most important to pass on in the message of suicide is working on people believing that suicide is preventable. You know, I always think of it like your feelings about not wanting to live can climb this big mountain. And if you end up ending your life at the top of that mountain, you don't realize that eventually you're going to come down the other side of the mountain. And I just really think that that's one of the main things we can do to improve our rates of how many people are dying in this horrible way is to let people know that there's still hope.
Dr. Sarah Coleman is a clinical psychologist with Milwaukee County's Behavioral Health Division. You can find more information and links to resources regarding suicide and suicide prevention at WUWM.com.
A Wisconsin native has taken the story of some of the first women to serve in the American military and made it into a documentary. We'll hear about the Hello Girls when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Thank you.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. As we approach the centennial anniversary of Armistice Day, there has been a growing conversation about the impact the First World War had on the U.S. and the world as a whole. Now celebrated as Veterans Day, the war famously ended at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918.
While the U.S. didn't enter the war until 1917, by the time the tensions ceased, more than 4 million American military personnel had been mobilized, including some of the first women to serve in the U.S. Army.
The Hello Girls were women switchboard operators on the front lines. Trenches were equipped with telephones, which enabled soldiers to send important messages from the front lines. But although the Hello Girls were in the trenches, their military service wasn't officially recognized for another 7 decades after they returned home.
Filmmaker James Theres tells Lake Effect's Joy Powers that he was inspired to make his documentary called The Hello Girls when he first heard about their service. But the Racine native learned about the group of switchboard operators from the early 20th century in a decidedly 21st century fashion.
I did a Google search, but not specifically for them. I did a Google search for World War I. I knew that anniversary was coming up this year. And so I was looking for a story that I wanted to tell in film. So I Googled World War I, and the book The Hello Girls, America's First Female Soldiers, written by Elizabeth Cobbs, came up in the search, in the top 10 of the Google search. And I looked down, and I said, oh, that's very interesting. And so I got to her author page, and I sent her an email, and it just so happened that in a month, and this was June of last year, in a month she was coming to Washington, D.C. to give a lecture on the Hello Girls. She said, I'd love to be part of your documentary, and that's how it happened.
It is a forgotten bit of history. As someone who, you know, has obviously gone through school, studied a fair amount of American history, I knew nothing about the Hello Girls. And it kind of made me wonder, how did it get buried in the first place?
Yeah, you know, I think you really have to mentally transport yourself 100 years ago. And just the fact that women, these women and other women were starting to get into the workplace, that was a huge leap. And you have to remember, women didn't even have the right to vote when these women went to war. So it was a different time, and, you know, they went over, and I think the women knew that they were doing something that was going to be significant for women. I don't know if they captured all of it, but they wanted to be the best at what they did, and ultimately they were, because I think they realized they were setting the stage, and when they came back, it changed President Wilson's mind about women's suffrage. He was adamantly against it. And when they came back and the other women came back, he realized the world was changing, and he wanted to give them the right to vote.
Yeah. As you mentioned, this was a time in which women were really starting to get into the workplace, and these women were already working for the phone companies here in the U.S., and that was one of the reasons they were chosen to go to the front lines. Why did they bring over women instead of having men who might have already been in the Army controlling the phone boards?
A couple of things. Now, you got to think that they had been at war for 3 years, and when the Americans came in, they were very fresh, and they were using telephone technology over there, but they were just fresh. So there was the English and French women, and then there was the men. Well, General Pershing wasn't happy with either of those two. The men didn't really want to do the job, and they could only connect a call in 60 seconds. Well, the women were trained to connect that call in 10 seconds here in the United States. You know, General Pershing knew that, and the people that were with him were a lot of AT&T officers that came from AT&T, and they crossed over to be Army officers. And they said, we got these women that are all already trained in this. And so General Pershing wrote, cabled back to the War Department and said, hey, I need women soldiers. I need them uniformed, and I need them over here.
Oh, and he called them soldiers.
Yes.
Which, of course, came up much later, and we'll get to that in a moment. But how were these women specifically chosen for this job? Out of all the women who are already working in the U.S., how did these women get chosen to become what would become the Hello Girls?
Right. The first call for women was 100 women, and 7,600 women applied for those 100 jobs, which is very interesting in that all of the women volunteered for World War One, and half of the men did. Now, the numbers for the men were much larger, but all of the women volunteered. The first group of women, the first couple of groups, needed to be English and French speakers, so that was a priority. They also, some of them, not all of them, had already worked for AT&T or were already, you know, working for AT&T as telephone operators. And not all, but several of them had college education or were in college at the time. Grace Banker had graduated from Barnard College. So they had kind of those three things. They were a little bit more educated. They spoke English and French. And some had already been working for AT&T.
Now, as you were going through your research, you found a couple of women, at least, who were actually from Wisconsin. Can you tell me a bit about their journeys?
Yeah, very interesting. I think I can tell you, I don't know much about Margaret Hanen, except that she settled in Green Bay. But I can tell you a great story about Hildegard Van Brunt. She was born in Paris. She came to the United States, and then she went back to serve in the war as a telephone operator. And so her mother went overseas, too, served in the Red Cross. Well, Hildegard, when she came back, just kind of went on with her life and married a World War One soldier, and that's why they came back to Milwaukee. So fast forward to her granddaughter. Her granddaughter never knew. She had pictures of her grandmother, but never knew what she had done. She thought, you know, the family story was that she went overseas and worked for the Red Cross. Well, the local reporter, Meg Jones from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, did a story on the Hello Girls and asked to see her grandmother's photo. And sure enough, she had a Hello Girl uniform on and the armband. And that's when she found out what her grandmother really did, that she was a telephone operator in this historic group of 223 women.
So that history had even been lost inside of their family.
It has been lost. It was lost inside of the family. I will even say that when I brought this to the attention of AT&T, it was kind of lost. Their historian knew about it, and they knew a book had recently been written. But within the organization, it was kind of lost that 100 years ago they played such a significant role in World War One, helping us win that war and the Allies.
Well, and the Hello Girls faced a similar fate to many female veterans who would follow them. Specifically, they were told when they came back that they weren't veterans, that they had never been a part of the Army. And it took a very long time for them to get official recognition.
All right. Yeah, well, it took 60 years. And it really comes down to one word, one or two words, the word man and men. So when the Navy wrote their regulations, the Navy and the Marine Corps wrote their regulations, they basically said that any person can serve. They used the word person. So those women who didn't deploy but certainly served a significant role in Navy and Marines here in the States, I think there was about 13,000 of them. After the war, they got veteran status. So Navy and Marine women did. Well, the Army, when it wrote its regulations, the whole regulation is peppered with the word man or men. There is no mention of a person. There is no mention of women. So when they came back, that's what the Army and the government stood by and said, no, you were contractors. But they actually took Army oaths. They wore uniforms. They were subject to military law. But that regulation and the intransigence and not wanting to change that regulation is what held them up for 60 years.
60 years later, how did they finally prove that they were a part of the Army?
So throughout that whole 60-year period, Merle Egan from Montana, she kind of led the fight along with some other women and the National Organization for Women. So during that time, over 50 bills had been introduced in Congress, but never got to the point where they were voted on and just kind of died in the process. And then in the early 70s, a young attorney by the name of Mark Ho, he read an article in Seattle about Merle Egan and her fight to get recognition for these women. and he contacted her, and he was an attorney, and he helped her out. He kind of organized everything. And so he was getting ready to prepare a case against the government to get these women their recognition. But then they found out, along with the National Organization for Women, that Senator Barry Goldwater and Senator Daniel Inouye and Congresswoman Lindy Boggs out of Louisiana were working on legislation to get the World War II women, who were also forgotten by the government, the pilots and stuff, was working on legislation to get them recognition. And so Mark Hoel contacted Senator Goldwater's office and said, hey, here's another group of women from World War I. And so they added their names to the legislation, and then that's how it happened by 1977.
When we look back at the story of the Hello Girls, their fight for recognition, and their service during World War I, what do you think we learn about the U.S. Army?
You know, what we learned is that, one, everything has a starting place. You know, when you build and you're standing on people's shoulders, it starts somewhere. And I think it's very important that you find out where that starting place is. I think number two, the Army found out that men and women could work together in close quarters. They were very skeptical of that. They just didn't think that that was possible, that men and women could work together so closely. And they found out, indeed, that they could. And I think the last thing is that when it comes to American citizenship, serving in the military has always been kind of a gateway or a pathway to being recognized as citizens. And that was kind of what the Hello Girls, maybe unintentionally, they kind of did. When they put on the uniform and served overseas in combat, because they were in combat, at least via artillery fire and airplanes, they kind of said to everyone else, look, we are citizens. We want our voice to be heard. And that's also where that started. So I think the Army learned, through the Army, they learned a couple things. But specifically for the Army, they learned that men and women could work together. I did want to mention, very exciting, I don't know if it's opportunity or development, a group of us working alongside with the World War I Centennial Commission here in Washington, D.C., are working with some members of Congress, specifically right now Senator Tester's office, to secure the Congressional Gold Medal for the women. And hopefully that happens. Other groups that have earned that medal are the Tuskegee Airmen, the Montford Point Marines, the Filipino veterans, and even the women, some women of World War II, the WASPs, the Women Army Pilots, got that medal. So we're hoping that Congress will see that these women deserve that same recognition. And so we're working on that right now.
Wisconsin native James Theris is a documentary maker whose film The Hello Girls airs on Wisconsin Public Television tomorrow morning at 10:30. Theris spoke with Joy Powers, and there is more information about The Hello Girls at WUWM.com.
Another quick break, and then the story of a one-woman show on stage this weekend and the two Milwaukee theater companies that collaborated to put it on. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Funny. Did you hear that? Funny.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Theater Red has been presenting shows on Milwaukee stages since 2013. That's relatively young as far as Milwaukee theater companies go, but it's positively a veteran group compared to the brand new group called Untitled Productions. The two organizations are joining up to present a one-woman show on stage this weekend.
I'll Eat You Last stars Theater Red's Marcy Darty Elst as Sue Mangers, show business agent to the stars and host of infamous dinner parties. Darty Elst is also Theater Red's producing director. She joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North and explained what led to the creative partnership behind the show.
Theater Red is partnering with Untitled Productions, which is a brand new theater company here in Milwaukee, started by my friend Eric Welch. Him and his friend Brianna Lepore started talking about this idea over a year ago about, wow, there are shows we'd love to see that we don't see around town. They wanted to really bring back some of the old classic musicals that they don't see done anymore, and also some new works. And Eric is an enormous Barbra Streisand fan and a big Bette Midler fan. So we, of course, heard about this play, which, of course, Bette Midler did this play in 2011 at the Booth Theater in New York, playing Sue Mangers. And this play fascinated him. He's always kind of liked it ever since he heard about it. So when he started talking about starting his own company, he thought, okay, well, what can I start with as a brand new theater company and as a first-time director? So he thought, I'm going to do this one-woman show, and I know exactly who I want as this one woman. And it's interesting. I think you learn a lot about what people think of you when they either write a show for you or cast you in a show without an audition. So I was like, wow, is that really what he thinks of me? Am I like Sue Mangers? But he promises
Are
no.
You?
No, I don't think so. I think you know what I have in common with Sue Mangers is her drive and her loyalty. I don't share her vices or her potty mouth. And for people that know her, she was a very polarizing personality. Most people hated her, but the people that knew her and that she was close to loved her, and she really fought for her clients. She had a dream, and she had such drive and determination. That's what I like to think I share with her, is that drive and determination.
So for people who don't know who she is, who was she?
Sue Mangers is referred to as Hollywood's first super agent. So she was an agent back in the heyday of Hollywood agenting. So we're talking 60s, 70s, and early 80s. But even by like the late 80s, 90s, really the landscape in Hollywood started to change in movie land. But she was most famous for being Barbra Streisand's agent, but she also represented a ton of other really famous people. In addition to being Barbara's agent, they were dear friends. And they had a falling out in the early 80s, and they didn't speak for a long period of time. Then they kind of came back onto speaking terms, but that friendship was never really as strong as it was. But at the time that this play takes place, in 1981, they're very good friends. So what's happening is you're sitting in Sue Menger's living room the night that she's expecting a telephone call from Barbra Streisand. So, and I'm not giving anything away because Sue Mangers tells you immediately when she sits down that this is what's going on. So she's waiting for a phone call from Barbara because Barbara's lawyers fired her that morning. And Sue says, well, I'm not going to believe that until I hear it from Barbara. And they say, well, she'll call you tonight. So when the play starts or when you join Sue, she's sitting in her living room waiting for this phone call, waiting for this shoe to drop, and filled with a lot of emotions. And she's both ready to fight and ready to cry. This is her best friend in the world and someone who she came up with. So that's kind of what happens. And there's this nervous energy that she has, and you're sitting in her living room and she's talking to you. So she starts telling you gossip and stories and dishing like she would at her parties. And then through the course of that, you start to see some of the real Sue. You start to hear about her childhood, the things that shaped her, the things that hurt her, and you start to understand more about her drive and more about the person she is. But this is happening in 1981 at a certain point in time.
For you as an actor, what are some of the particular challenges of being the only person on stage?
Gosh, I'm a little bit more than a little terrified, right? And people say, if you weren't, you'd be crazy. I've never done a one-woman show before. I've had scenes where I had a monologue or I was the only person on stage, but never by myself. So the biggest challenge, I think, is being able to keep myself on my story trajectory, because if I go up or if I kind of blank, I don't have anybody there helping me. And she's telling so many stories, her mind is kind of rambling, and it's not necessarily a linear path. It's very log linear. She's just sitting there talking. So sometimes things have to make a sharp left turn. And, you know, I'm worried that I won't remember all those turns on this winding road. And it's not in a traditional theater space. So it's not like I have a stage manager in the wings. We do have a stage manager, but she's going to be sitting in the back of the ballroom at the Journeyman Hotel. So I don't have someone in the wings that can go, Vanessa Redgrave. You know, like cue me on the story or,
right.
You know.
You need big cue cards.
Right, like a cue. Yeah. Yeah, like a sign. Yeah, maybe I should have Allison make a bunch of those. Like, this is the Gene Hackman story. Gene Hackman.
Just have the names. Right. You know, it can be part of the action.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So that's the biggest challenge. And what I've tried to tell myself is the flip side of being nervous about that, the positive is that there's an awful lot of strength and empowerment in the fact that when you're flying the plane, if I lose my train of thought, I'm in control of what happens next, and the audience doesn't need to know that it was a mistake. So I'm trying to empower myself and think positively. The second challenge is that she's a smoker, a chain smoker. She also smokes illegal substances during the show, and I'm not a smoker. I've never been. So learning how to smoke, because I will be smoking an herbal cigarette. The hotel is very much fine with smoke in the room. So we're using an actual set of, we're using real cigarettes. So learning how to smoke, learning how to make it look natural while I'm talking and smoking, learning how to hold it in my hand. And
particularly of that generation, too.
Yes.
Because there was a certain way that people lived with cigarettes.
Yes.
That are very different. Even if people smoke now, it's very different.
Right. And I mean, you think of Bette Davis, right? Like the way she holds the cigarette. So those are big challenges for me. And having a prop in your hand the entire time is also kind of the first couple rehearsals, I would go to brush my hair back with the hand that was holding the cigarette. And Eric would say, you know, stop. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't want to set your hair on fire or ash in your hair. You wouldn't do that with the cigarette in your hand. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
And so why the choice of the journeyman? I mean, did you want it to be in a less traditional space on purpose?
Kind of, yeah. When Eric first approached me with the idea and said, I would like you to play Sue Mengers, after I got over my initial terror and started actually thinking about how we would do this, because the play takes place in her living room, and, you know, she's in a Beverly Hills mansion, so it's well-appointed. And you're sitting in her living room, you know, basically, you know, around her couch. I got this idea, like, it might be kind of fun to stage this in somebody's living room. And as I got thinking more about that, I went, okay, how does that actually work? So I said, what if we staged it in a hotel suite and just sold 15 tickets a night? Whoever could fit in the suite, have them sit in there and have it be very real, very immersive. So Eric liked that idea, and we started thinking about what hotels we might want to do this in. And I said, you know, the Journeyman is sort of new on the scene in the Third Ward. They're in this great area. Their aesthetic is beautiful and modern and hip, but still has some traditional elements. I really like the Journeyman Hotel. So Eric actually went into the Journeyman one day and said, hey, I'd like to talk to, you know, whoever you have in charge of sales or marketing, or I've got, or a manager. I have this interesting idea for a theatrical production. The Journeyman folks loved the idea, and they liked it so much, they actually said, well, why would you limit yourself to 15 tickets a night? And we said, well, because that's probably all we could really fit in the suite. They said, ah, we've got all this furniture. We'll just rebuild a suite in our ballroom for you, put it up on a stage, and then you can sell 80 tickets. So it's really kind of a cool setup. There's a bar in the back of the room that will be serving drinks during the entire show. That's actually also important for the plot. So people will be encouraged to get up and get drinks, bring them to their table. So it's really kind of, I think, kind of a neat setup. But that's kind of how that came about. It's one of these weird ideas that Marcy has, like, oh, let's do this here.
We're used to the idea of a house concert with music.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same idea. It's literally in somebody's living room or somebody's back room or something like that. And you fit in whoever you can fit in. And you have that really wonderful, intimate experience.
Yeah.
I'm just so happy that theaters are doing the same sorts of things. It's not that theaters didn't in the past. It just seems like now is a time that people are embracing it, both audiences and theater practitioners,
mm-hmm.
where you kind of expand the definition of what theater is.
Right. I thought it would be really unique. And also there's a practical aspect of that, right? We're a small theater company. Untitled Productions is brand new. This is their first show ever. And so I went, wow, if we're going to try to create or build a set that looks like a well-appointed living room, wow. I wonder if I could just find one of those that I could just use, you know, kind
right.
of thing.
Who's got that budget?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's really kind of how that idea came about. But I think it's going to be really fun. And also, the show very much doesn't try to be a presentational, you're listening to her scene, applause. it really works best if the audience feels like they're kind of sitting in her living room in a casual environment where they're free to interact, where they're free to answer questions if she asks them, where they're free to get up and use the bathroom or go get a drink from the bar. That will actually be part of the show. And there's a couple of moments in the show where Sue needs help from the audience in order to get something done. The very first line of the play, she comes out, she sits down on the couch, she lights a cigarette, and she says, "I'm not getting up." And she doesn't. So when she needs something that's out of her arm's reach, she needs somebody to get it for her. So that will be another interesting challenge for me as an actor, because the plot cannot progress unless I get these items. There's quite a bit of improv that's involved in those scenarios because you just don't know exactly what will happen.
And who's going to be there.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that should be fun, and that will be new for me as well. Anytime I've improv before, it's been out of necessity, not out of, you know.
Design.
Design. Should be fun.
It should be. It sounds like it's going to be terrific. Marcy, best of luck with it.
Thank you.
And it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me here. I love seeing you and chatting with you always.
Marcy Doherty Else is the producing director of Theater Red and stars in the one-woman show I'll Eat You Last. She spoke with Bonnie North. The co-production with the group Untitled Productions runs tomorrow through Sunday at the Kempton Journeyman Hotel in the Third Ward. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then our astronomy contributor talks about the celestial objects that could end life as we know it here on Earth. It is not quite as scary an interview as you think, but it is coming up next on Lake Effect from WUWM. I guess I didn't make it, but whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion. That's great, it starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and airplanes. Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's a lot of things that can go wrong in a day. Your car could break down, you could spill coffee on your new shirt, you might come down with a nasty cold, or maybe athlete's foot. None of those is a lot of fun.
But they all seem like a walk in the park in comparison to what we're talking about this month with astronomy contributor Gene Creighton. Hi, Gene. Very nice to see you.
Hi, Mitch. Great to be here.
It's been a while since the two of us have had a chance to talk, so I'm thrilled to get a chance to do this month's conversation with you. We're talking about near-Earth objects that I guess NASA has identified as targets. Before we get into what they are, let's talk about exactly what a near-Earth object is and how near to the Earth we're talking.
So a near-Earth object is either a comet or an asteroid that gets within 30 million miles from our surface, which might sound like a really long way away, but that's just 100 times the distance to the moon. And some of these orbits are very elliptical, so they can get a whole lot closer. I think it's particularly what raises alarms is if it's going to be anywhere between the Earth and the moon.
That would certainly alarm a lot of people.
Yes. Then we're paying close attention. But in principle, objects in that distance range, about 100 times the distance to the moon, could in principle get that close.
Well, and what's appealing about going out and looking at these things?
I'm not sure that appealing is the right term. I think NASA and other agencies, space agencies around the world, recognize that that is a real threat. Whereas most of the time, space is a lovely place to inspire us and make us reach for the stars, as it were. This is the kind of thing that actually could destroy a large city or civilization, see the dinosaur extinction. So this is one of the few things that space can bring us bad news. So the idea is that if we know where these objects are and when they're likely to get close, we can actually do something about it. The key point being having enough time. If you find something like, oh, this is going to hit us next week, then our choices would be very few and not very good. So the hope is that if we study them and we track them, we'll be able to identify the ones that might cause us a headache in time.
Now, if I remember correctly, not so long ago, there was not any real full-time effort devoted to studying asteroids that could potentially come into contact with Earth. How is NASA going about studying them today?
It actually has been since the 70s that people have been keeping their eyes open. Let me just say that NASA, I found this title amusing, has a planetary defense officer.
Maybe a thankless job.
a thankless job, but boy, you hope not to be needed. So we have found 18,000 such objects, 18,300 about. And of those, 8,000 we track reasonably well because they're over 328 feet or 100 meters. Anything that big that's traveling on the order of 80,000 miles an hour could certainly take out a city. And if it hit certain parts of the world, it could take out significant fractions of the population. So we would want to make sure that, as I said, we know if such a thing is happening. You might ask, well, what's the point of knowing if we can't do anything about it?
Right. If there's a planetary defense officer, what kind of defense might he have or she have to offer?
We have basically two choices. We would either deflect or we would disrupt. And these are kind of similar sounding words. Deflection means that you would send an impactor that would push it just a little bit. If you had enough warning, a small change could miss the Earth by many, many thousands of miles to make it perfectly safe and reassuring for us. The other option is, what if it's too big and that doesn't work? Then we would probably try and break it into smaller pieces so that even some of it fell to the Earth, it wouldn't, take out life as we know it or destroy our planet. After all, the moon formed by something the size of Mars, a fairly large thing, hit the Earth, totally destroyed the impactor, and rearranged some of the mantle to make the moon. So these things could happen.
Something, though, that's moving at 80,000 miles per hour would seem like it would be fairly hard to hit, and depending on how large it is, difficult to do something about. What kinds of man-made materials could we use to deflect or at least partially destroy before it came to Earth?
Well, for the deflection, we're literally thinking we would send something like a rocket. And that would be enough if it's targeted. I mean, I'm actually amazed how well we understand orbital mechanics and how much detail we're capable of anticipating how to hit a target. I do see the problem. What if what we send isn't sufficiently powerful to actually change its course enough? And the farther ahead we know of this, the less we need to change its course. If it turns out that something big that was hiding and that we found kind of at the last minute, as it were, like, say, 5 years in advance as opposed to 15, well, then we might have to consider our other options, and you would probably need some kind of weapon to break it. And I know that in the past there have been conversations about, well, do we really want to send nuclear weapons? Well, we might not have a whole lot of choices.
Given the size of these objects, are they especially difficult to see?
Yes. Yes, because they are small, ultimately. There are people who look for comets. That's what they do as a hobby. But oftentimes you will find out about them, a few months before they're naked eye objects, right? So we're looking for, we want a much better timeline than that. I feel like this conversation has taken a rather dark turn, and I want to reassure our lovely listeners that what we're discussing is incredibly unlikely. It's just that it is one of those things that in principle could, at some point. Something big will hit the earth in the fullness of time. It's just that if we are unlucky enough that this happens in the near future, that we have a plan to deal with it. So it's nice to discuss these in a philosophical fashion long before we actually have real serious choices to make.
But it sounds like as a scientist, you would be more concerned about being in a car accident than being hit by a near-Earth object.
Much more, yes. I don't spend any time, I don't lose any sleep on near-Earth objects. But I do think these are interesting problems to tackle. I don't know if you recall, we had a few months ago pieces of a Chinese satellite falling in the sky, and it turns out that it's hard to predict exactly when and where these pieces will fall. So those kind of questions fine-tune our ability to predict these motions, and I guess it helps to more accurately estimate the probability of near-Earth object interactions.
Well, and you mentioned the pieces of the Chinese satellite that came falling to Earth. It's a fairly common occurrence that that either space junk or other debris from outer space actually makes its way through the atmosphere, right?
That's true. We should point out that these pieces of debris are significantly smaller and they're traveling at much lower speeds. So most of these actually disintegrate in our atmosphere, and most of them are on trajectories that are intended to fall in the ocean so that when they eventually lose their altitude, they do something safe and plunge somewhere in the Pacific.
Well, and so before we wrap up, we talk about NASA studying these potential targets. How is it doing it? Is it using space-based telescopes to see them?
Yes. One of the instruments that they used was called WISE, and that's an infrared instrument. Infrared is very useful in this because these rocks don't glow, of course, they're not stars, but they do emit some infrared radiation, and we're able to kind of catalog those. They are particularly concerned about things that are 1,000, so more than 3,000 feet across, because those really are doozers. WISE gave us the very happy information that the asteroids that are that big are fewer than we had predicted. So we were able to actually see them in the sky, and based on our models, we realized there's fewer than we expected, which is just as well.
Sounds like a happy note to end on.
Okay, very good.
Jean, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and our regular astronomy contributor. You can listen to all of our conversations with her at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's the end of the world.